Hi everyone, welcome at WaveX. Today with Glenn Rothwell from Alchemy. And we will talk about all things sales, BD, also business development, and all the kind of stuff, mindset, leadership. And yeah, you see, Ernesto can't wait anymore, so let's dive in.
WaveX, the web-free software company that understands what you want.
Hi mate, thanks for your time. It's really a pleasure having you here. Yeah, just to jump directly into it, you have a rich sales experience and recently joined Alchemy back in August last year. From my knowledge, that's your first Web3 role actually, right? So
that's correct, yeah.
I'm just wondering, what's the biggest difference in terms of like working as a salesperson in non-Web3, however you want to call it, Web2, whatever, and actually Web3 infrastructure, actually?
Yeah, so the biggest difference from a personal standpoint is now I finally get to do for work what I was passionate about outside of work before, right? So that was the coolest part for me. Was I've been involved in crypto for the past 10 years, and it always felt like I could never, you know, talk about the things I was most interested in learning about with the majority of my coworkers. So it's nice in that sense that now I get to blend together two of the things I'm most passionate about, which is sales and business development, as well as crypto and blockchain technology and culture, which is awesome. The biggest difference from the actual like day-to-day and in sales process and the role just has to go with how you go about making connections with new prospective customers. I would say in traditional software sales, it's all, you know, cold calls, emails, maybe a little bit of LinkedIn or social prospecting, all the usual stuff that if you're like looking up sales training videos on YouTube, you'll like see all these things. Whereas in Web3 and crypto, I think there's a high value put on actually being an active participant in the communities in order for people to respect you and take you seriously. So it's not to say you can't get away with doing traditional methods. But I think it's more valuable to make authentic connections, actually be an active participant in these communities, meet people at events and because you're fellow community members. And then, you know, if there's some way that your product or services can help them, it kind of comes up naturally in conversation that way.
Now, there's something I've observed in the last year, actually, and I'm pretty sure it's a trend that's going on for longer or has always been there. But do you think that's Web3 specific or just a general cold outbound approach, basically, like building relationships that has been emerged due to AI tools like overflooding your inboxes on LinkedIn or people just sending you tons of spam emails? Like, what's your take on that?
Totally. So I think this is also true in regular Web2 sales. I think it's just magnified even more within Web3 because the channels where we connect and interact with people are different than Web2, right? What I mean by that is blockchain and crypto is like an inherently privacy-focused space. Therefore, for example, if I find your cell phone number in a random database and I cold call you out of the blue, you know, even in regular Web2 sales, that might, you know, have a negative reaction from someone. But in Web3, it's almost like someone has a panic moment and they're like, how did my number get out there? Is this tied to any other like accounts, you know, and things like that? So therefore, like, you know, we tend to do prospecting through like Twitter or Telegram. I still use email, of course, but I think it's like magnified in Web3 because the channels that you connect and chat with people are just different. And there's that increased focus on privacy, and many people in the space, as you know, are anonymous. But to your point of like, is this also relevant in traditional Web2 sales? I think absolutely. Like in the last role that I was at for almost 3 years, we definitely saw a drop off during the pandemic because everybody started just using email blasts at a very big scale. And anytime that a new tactic gets like overplayed and everybody starts doing it, how effective that is goes down over time, right? So like when I first started doing this in 2016, like there was a new technology where you could spoof area code when you made a cold call, right? So I could make my phone number area code match yours. So it was called a local dial, and you'd be more likely maybe to pick up. That was awesome for like a year and a half until everybody started doing it. And then all of a sudden, actually more people would decline my calls if I did local dial. So, right, then it became the inverse. So it's kind of always that thing, I think, in sales where anytime that you have like a proprietary or novel way of doing something, eventually everybody starts doing it, and then it becomes less effective. Absolutely. And I think with time, this is something that's actually a positive development in sales, because something that I really don't like is when salespeople use tactics that someone might view as like tricky, right? You never want your first impression with someone to be that they feel like they're tricked, or they like accidentally picked up the phone because they thought it was like their kid's school calling or something like that, right? It's so much better to just make an authentic connection with people and have them actually want to talk to you and learn more about what it is you have to offer, as opposed to having someone feel like they accidentally ended up in this situation.
Yeah. Nobody likes being sold to, right?
Of course.
That's
not if it doesn't feel natural, right? I think there is something to be said for being sold to if you actually have a problem that can be solved, and if the person is doing it in a way that A, shows they know what they're talking about and they come from a position of, you know, education and understanding you, and two, coming from a place of wanting to get to know you and understand your business, as opposed to just pushing a product, right? There's a very big difference.
Absolutely. The funny thing is, I hate cold calls. And,
yeah.
You know, I just got one today during a train ride. And interestingly, it was one of those few actually that said good cold calls, right? It was relevant. They had a reference where they got my number, basically. And I ended up being a lead in their database. Like, let's do the trial. Let's do it. Right? And as I said, it's about building relationships, right? If you create a relationship through other means, like Telegram, Discord, cold calls, whatever, why not? Right? It's just more difficult because many people do it, and it has a negative association with it, right? That's the issue, maybe.
That's really cool. What about that cold call made you pay attention and not hang up on the person?
Yeah, first of all, I wasn't in a rush, right? That's always a precondition. I was just sitting in the train and did my major work, and yeah. And secondly, I asked twice to actually understand who is calling, like which company, because most often you don't understand that. And it just was relevant. It was a problem that I have right now, or something I want to improve on. And yeah, there's no risk because it's free. There's no payment, nothing. Let's just try it. You know, it's a no-brainer. Make an offer so good you can't refuse it. But it's basically that. So,
And that also shows that, like, and this is something that I believe, right? Sales is all about persistence, but it's also about having the right time. The persistence part is important because, you know, this person maybe could have called you 6 months or 12 months ago, and this wouldn't have been a relevant issue. But then if they keep in touch in a non-invasive, you know, way, or it's obviously you wouldn't want them calling you every day, but probably doesn't hurt to check in with that person like every couple months, see how things are, and wait for the right opportunity when it's more relevant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's all social skills, right? You just don't want to be taken advantage of.
Of course.
In the end.
Yeah.
What made you actually go into sales? Because it's, from my opinion, humble opinion, a really, really tough career path. So what made you do it?
Yeah, my story, I think, is similar to a lot of people, which is that I actually didn't intend to. It just kind of happened. A little bit of my backstory is I actually studied engineering for 2 years in college because I thought that's what I wanted to do. I went to a college where there was a lot of entrepreneurship going on, a lot of students who were working on building businesses also when they were in school. And I got involved with that community, and that actually excited me a lot more than the stuff that I was doing in class. So because of that, I ended up pivoting and like changing my major a couple times in college. I ended up graduating with product design and business degrees. And there were two professors in particular who really opened my eyes in the business program about just the fact that sales can be a real, you know, valuable kind of career path, and that it's not something to be ashamed of. It's still in my head, though, because I went in thinking I wanted to be an engineer or do something more technical. It definitely wasn't my intention when I graduated, but I think those two professors in particular kind of planted this idea as like a seed in the back of my head. Anyway, long story short, it came to be graduation and I didn't have a job offer lined up because I was actually trying to work on a startup company of my own at the time. And it soon became clear that this idea was not going to become profitable in the time that I needed to start paying back my student loans. So I was in a situation where I needed to get a job rather quickly. And I found that there's all these sales positions out there that will hire people maybe with a little bit less like technical background or skills or whatever. And it's more about like, you know, what you actually produce, right? You join a job, you go through the training program, you're held to a quota, you have like a ramp period. And that's kind of the cool thing about sales is if you're good, like you still have a job. And if you're not, like it's a meritocracy based kind of role, I guess is what I'm getting at. That really scared me, by the way, at first. I got my first sales job. I really thought I was going to be fired or like find another job within the first 6 months because I was a very antisocial kind of like, not very, but definitely more introverted than I am now, I would say. And so it really put me outside my comfort zone, like the fact that I had to make 100 cold calls a day. I viewed this more as just like something to pay the bills while I figure out what the next step is. And then I accidentally discovered something that I'm really passionate about. So long story short, I just kind of like stumbled into this because I needed a job and this was a career path that would hire me quickly. And then I got into it and I really liked the fact that it is a culture based on meritocracy and based on performance, and it's, you know, proportionate. The amount of effort and dedication and study you put into it is proportionate to the amount that you get out, which is really cool and is hard to find, I think, sometimes in other career paths.
Yeah, well, in sales, as you said, you have that advantage and disadvantage at the same time, right? That it's easy to connect your output to actual monetary value. And that's, I think, one of the few professions where you can actually do that. The other one is being a founder, right? Which you tried during or after college. But is there a universe where you think, I want to become an entrepreneur or founder again, or do you think it was the right, as it was probably the right decision, but do you feel like you want to try it again?
I definitely would try it again in the future. Like, I'm still very much an entrepreneurial person. That's always why I've worked at startup companies. I definitely prefer that compared to large companies. I once tried working at a large company and I quit after 5 months. I knew literally on day two it was like a mistake.
Can't imagine.
So I've always had like the startup bug. I love working with other people who are entrepreneurial. I think the answer is I definitely would consider that in the future. It's just, as you probably know, being a business owner and an entrepreneur yourself, it's all about, you know, the right timing and having the right idea. I think I'm still at the point in my career right now where I'm accumulating a lot of skills and still learning things that will hopefully be valuable down the road in the future.
That's a great mindset, right? Always be a student, not a teacher, too early at least, right?
Of course.
So that's pretty cool. Let's go back to sales a little bit. You mentioned that the channels are different, Discord, Telegram, and so on and so forth. Like, is it also different how you communicate, how you sell? Highly likely, right? Because you probably just can't send a huge email anymore with a company presentation and whatever. It's different, right?
Well, it always depends on who your audience is and who you're selling to, right? So I've sold a lot of different types of products, and the way that I've gone about communicating the value proposition of those, or just the way that I've gone about messaging, has been different in every role, right? The first job I had, I was literally selling printing services. Like, it was online printing, upload your PDF and get it printed and shipped like around the world kind of thing, right? A lot of the people there, like, they just cared more about transactional things, like what price is it to get, like, this document printed? How much money can you save me? How much time can you save me compared to, like, doing this myself, that kind of thing, right? So there, it was actually really successful sending, like, emails that had, like, bullet points with that kind of information in it, because that's what people cared about. And this was a commodity that they were already used to. It's not like blockchain where you need to explain like a new novel concept to people or sell something really revolutionary, right? So I think it totally depends on what you're selling, but it also depends on who you're selling to. Like, selling to developers is a completely different ballgame. I had a rude awakening in my first job selling to software engineers, where I realized the usual way of cold calling and communicating with people is just totally different. You know, I feel like most software engineers inherently don't trust salespeople. So it's much better, rather than trying to tell them about all the amazing things your product can do, share like a similar story or some social proof of how you helped solve a challenge for somebody similar to them, and then see if they're interested in also learning about that, or if that's something relevant to their day-to-day, right? It's a very different way of doing something. Instead of telling somebody about benefits, you're basically storytelling about how you help someone similar to them solve a problem and seeing if that resonates with them. So I've since modified, you know, my messaging a lot based on that. And then in Web3, it's even different just because of the whole degen culture, right? When I prospect someone now, it's like I'll use a joke, or I'll just say like GM as my intro, or like something like that. It's a much shorter, faster kind of communication style, and certainly not sending like bulleted lists of information.
Quick intermission. If I could ask you for one single favor, it would be that you hit subscribe onto this channel, because it helps our channel more than you can imagine. And, you know, the bigger the channel gets, the bigger the guests get. So thank you very much for watching, and let's continue with the episode.
Yeah, that basically ties also into people buy from people they like, trust, and that are like them.
Right? Of course.
Where they feel like some kind of closeness to them. Like, when selling to developers, right, at Alchemy, you basically, I guess, you somewhat also sell to developers, at least indirectly, right? You have to convince them otherwise. The company, the founder, who oftentimes might be a developer, won't buy into Alchemy as well. How is, if I can ask, the sales cycle, how does it work at Alchemy? Like, from an infrastructure perspective, I can imagine it's, because it's a much more invasive thing to integrate into your software stack, that, of course, it's probably much more difficult than just selling a tool or something like that.
So first of all, I would say, like, it's actually relatively easy to try to like test out Alchemy. So it, because it's like, you know, because of the nature of what we do, which is we provide access to read and write data from the blockchain in the simplest way, a lot of this is based on like open methods, right, that other providers have. Well, what I'm getting at is like RPC and like how that works in general, right? So the switching cost is actually relatively low for people, which is one of the awesome things about selling blockchain infrastructure, in my opinion. The kind of like you were saying, it was a no-brainer when this person cold called you earlier today, because the risk to you trying out their service was very minimal. It's actually pretty much the same case for blockchain infrastructure, for what Alchemy does, right? We don't make people do a demo of a product in order to try using it. We have a product like Growth Motion. We have a free tier product that anybody can try out. So in some cases, if someone's too busy to get on a phone call or a Zoom meeting, they can just try it out on their own and then send back like benchmark results compared to the other providers that they're having, right? So I think that's the big difference in selling to developers, is you want to bring down that friction as much as possible Nobody wants to feel like they're going through your sales process, right? They want to feel like it's a very easy, frictionless experience. Just, you know, a couple lines of code, I can start testing out Alchemy RPC endpoints, see how it compares, you know, in terms of data accuracy and speed and all those things compared to maybe my in-house nodes or my other provider, and then get instant feedback rather than going through some long kind of trial process. So getting back to your question about our sales cycle, it's actually much quicker than other products I've sold in the past. When I've sold enterprise software in the past, sales cycle might be 6 to 12 months, you know, and that's because you're going through like a very regimented trial or proof of concept process. Oftentimes it's much easier to start testing things, and because we are an infrastructure product, it's easy for people to start off using us a little bit, and then after they have a good experience, scale up with time.
Yeah, well, that actually also ties in into brand building and marketing itself, right? The more people that know about you, the more people will try out your service, and then you basically just have just it's difficult to convert them, right? What I see, you know, with infrastructure and blockchain specifically, there's a really unique aspect about it, especially when you look at actual blockchain infrastructure. It's all free, and infrastructure providers oftentimes have to subsidize or pay for people to use it with airdrops, whatever, grants, and so on and so forth. Like, how does that tie into your strategy, and do you see a trend where this reverses to a more, let's say, natural flow in terms of sales cycles?
Yeah. The one thing that Alchemy has done that I think really sets us apart there and is a great source of like customers to this day for us is Alchemy University, which is our education offering. So like in the past year, we had around 70,000 people go through that and take courses. Not sure the total numbers, but it's in the hundreds of thousands of people that have, you know, taken courses in Alchemy University. And because of that, this is something that it's like we're investing up front in the community. And of course, it costs us money to do that. But we're creating that as public good for the community to teach more developers, you know, Web3 development. And then if that's their first impression or their first experience of Alchemy, they're going to think of us positively when they go to build on, you know, build their dApp or their company or whatever it might be. And then they're going to come back to Alchemy. And by the way, when they signed up for Alchemy University, they had to create an Alchemy account. So they already have it and it's free to start, right? Until they start like sending a ton of traffic. So that's like a really nice product-led growth motion, I think, and a way to make an authentic entry in the space where you're actually providing more value to someone before asking anything in return for that. And the honest truth is, like, there is a cost for doing that, right? Not only in Web3, but in Web2. You look at companies like Amazon and Google, they have a startups program where they subsidize the cost of building for newer companies. But that's really making, like, a strategic bet on, you know, the fact that not all of these companies are going to pan out, but from there, we're going to find the next, you know, big tech companies from there who are going to scale and become very high-paying customers. We do the same thing here at Alchemy with our startup program, with our free tier, and I think many other infrastructure providers in the space do as well. So I actually don't think that's something that's unique to Web3 for infrastructure. I think what's unique to Web3 in terms of the how we're incentivizing people to use consumer apps, that is something that's very different when you're talking about airdrops or incentivizing people with a monetary incentive to use a dApp. For a lot of the consumer apps that we see in Web3, that is something that's very different, obviously, from normal software companies in Web2.
Well, really interesting. When just jumping back again a little bit, when you joined Alchemy, for example, in August last year, I'm just curious, like from a really experienced point of view, like, how do you actually get started at a new company? Because there's certain things you need to know to effectively sell software in a way that you are convinced of as well, right? Because if you're not convinced, you can't sell it. What are the things you usually do?
Yeah, So the biggest thing you can do as a salesperson to set yourself apart from your peers or like average salespeople is to try to get as technical as possible. That can be difficult to do with a product as technical as Alchemy because you can't demo our product if you're not a software developer, right? I mean, you can demo the dashboard and like certain aspects of it, but you know, you would have to, you know, basically be coding live in a screen share kind of environment to truly demo like all the things that Alchemy can do. So unlike some of the other products that I've sold in the past, because I'm not a developer, that part wasn't possible. But what was possible was to start like, you know, just immersing myself as much in the product, shadowing, you know, we use like call recording software and stuff. So I'm able to go back and listen to like calls that got more technical, start doing that stuff as early as possible. And anytime I hear a new term that I don't recognize, just write that down and then ask someone else on the team who's more tenured to help break that down or explain it. We're really lucky that we have like a very open and kind of flat culture here, in the sense where, you know, salespeople are friends with the developers and spending time with them, sitting with them. Like, it's very easy to get that knowledge sharing and information, whereas some of the companies I've worked in the past, that information was a lot more siloed. But definitely like asking all those questions about technical things you don't understand, getting as immersed in the product as possible early on. And then joining customer calls, even if it's just a listener shadow, that's really important as well, I think, from starting out. Another thing is just like try to use other like third-party tools that the people you're selling to are using as well, right? So for blockchain, that's pretty easy because everything is like open and accessible. So for BDR sales in blockchain, I would say like try out as many of the different kind of like protocols out there as you can. Like if you're joining a blockchain sales role and you've never like used like a bridge or a DEX or like some of these things that us Web3 natives might find to be, you know, commonplace, it's really important to do stuff like that. So when you're talking to a company that's a bridge or a DEX or something like that, you understand what they actually do. And for example, if I'm talking to a DEX, I know that like latency is really important to them because they want to make sure that people, you know, get the best trade execution possible. And if you have like, for example, an order book that's on chain, like that becomes really important. And even though I'm not a developer, I understand that because I've used some of these products and I've seen what a good user experience can be and what a bad user experience can be. And then I'm able to map that to how a service like Alchemy can actually help make that user experience better for the end user.
Mm-hmm. And what about processes? Like, of course, you usually have key account managers, or sales, SDRs. But like, how do you get into that? Like, because every company has different sales cycles, when to place certain contracts. How is that, and how do you get into that when joining a new company?
Mm-hmm. So my career path has been maybe a little bit different than most in that I started out as an SDR and then I went straight into SDR management. So I never went into the account executive role. So just for the listeners who might not know, in most like sales orgs, SDR or sales development rep is basically the hunter who's responsible for finding new leads or new customers kind of out of nowhere. And then typically in the split sales process, they'll take that lead or that customer and they'll make an introduction to an account executive who's a sales rep who's responsible for kind of taking the baton, nurturing that relationship, and ultimately closing the deal or securing the financial commitment. And then you also brought up another term, CSM or AM. That's like a customer success manager or an account manager. It varies a little bit in company to company. But those folks are the ones who are responsible then typically after the deal is closed for making sure the customer has a good experience. If you're an account manager, perhaps upselling the customer to additional services within your platform or suite of applications. So the way that most people get started in that is they start out as an SDR and then they go to an account executive. And then sometimes based on what they're interested in or what they're good at, they might make a lateral move to CSM or they might stay as an AE and then keep progressing up to like enterprise AE. For me, I knew from like early on that I wanted to get involved with leadership just because I personally get the most value from like helping other people on my team. It was something I always did even when I wasn't officially a leader on the team. And it's just something that's enjoyable to me. Like before I was working in blockchain sales, I wasn't always passionate about the products I was selling fully. Like sure, I found them interesting, but in order to really leave work every day and feel like fulfilled, I wanted to at least be in the type of role where I knew that I was helping other people on my team get better every day. So that's what, you know, made me gravitate towards the leadership. And now it's really best of both worlds because it's like I'm not only passionate about the role that I'm doing, but also passionate about the tech product that we're selling.
That's really interesting. And of course, right, if you're passionate about something, your sales skills basically skyrocket, right? Because people, right. Everything that's communicated with enthusiasm is 10 times more convincing.
Of course.
You know, it's just trust. And I'm just wondering, leadership, I totally understand that. That's really cool. But I'm pretty sure there are also, of course, managers of account executives. So what made you stay in that area? Because you said it's usual that you become an account executive, and from that perspective, it actually could make sense to then become an account executive manager, basically. Or what? Or did it just happen? I don't know.
Yeah, I think for me personally, like in order to manage account executives, typically you'd want someone who had been an account executive before, which I have not. So that's, I think, definitely part of it. But another part is like, I really like the SDR role. I like that motion of like finding new customers out of nowhere. I find that it's like a fun like chase that, I don't know, it's exciting to me. There's certainly like an element of pressure involved, and that's true in all of sales, right? You always have a number or a quota that you need to hit. But I just find it really rewarding, like when you see like a new customer or like a new deal that's closed, and you know that like that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for you, right? And that's certainly not to downplay the work that account executives do. It's very difficult. It's a very important job, but the lead wouldn't be there in the first place if an SDR didn't find it, right? And going back to what we were talking about before, it's so much harder to do prospecting effectively now that the SDR leaders who have evolved their tactics and have learned how to do custom outreach and who have learned to, you know, maybe pick up like a product-led growth or an account-based marketing kind of approach, those skills are actually really in high demand. And there's not a ton of SDR leaders out there who know how to do that stuff, which I think puts you in a valuable place in your career. So I think for those reasons, that's why, I mostly stuck with that path and continue to today.
Absolutely makes sense. Especially, you know, when you have your team, your job as a leader is to put your team into position to succeed, right? Which means if you have that skills, give it to them as best as possible. Train them, give them educational materials, whatever, right?
Of course.
Just if possible, of course. From that, there's one aspect about sales SDR that I find particularly interesting, because big companies, what usually happens if they want to scale or if they have an issue with outbound, they just raise the bar. They say, oh, the quota is higher now, you need to do that. And of course, SDRs might achieve that, the same for account executives, but what then might happen, of course, if it's done the wrong way, that people sell things they shouldn't sell to people.
Totally.
And that drops user retention or client retention, right? And I'm just wondering, because I have no idea about that part specifically, like how do you actually make sure that this trade or that this just doesn't happen? Like,
it might sound cliche, but like you have to be on the same page with the rest of leadership, right? Like if you have a, let's say a CEO or a founder who really doesn't understand sales and is like, has like a certain expectation or thinks that just by raising the quota, you're going to like get more results. Like that's where I've seen in prior roles and prior organizations where sometimes that gets misaligned. Similarly, like if you've got a VP of sales who has never, you know, worked closely with SDR, has been an SDR leader themselves. That's where I've seen some of the disconnects come up as well. Again, we're really lucky here that the head of sales at Alchemy has been an SDR manager twice before in his past. So we don't have any of those issues, and therefore I'm able just to have an honest conversation about like quota setting and expectations and stuff like that here. I think like quota is only part of it. The bigger mistake that I see a lot of companies, especially startups, making is just over hiring SDRs in general. They think that if we hire a team of 10 SDRs, it's going to solve all of our pipeline problems. But if you don't have product market fit or sales enablement materials to train that team, then you're just going to end up having to, unfortunately, part ways with those folks in 6 months. And I've seen that happen before as well. So, I mean, here at Alchemy, we only have a team of two. It's myself and one other person. We do plan on growing that a little bit this year, but we're not in a rush to add like a drastic amount of headcount. You know, and that's just, again, something I appreciate about like the culture and leadership here is that we understand that it takes time to build things, especially in an industry that's as new and cutting edge and exciting as Web3. But that's probably the number one mistake I've seen leaders make with this in the past, is just think that by throwing more people at a problem, when really the real issue is probably product market fit or sales enablement or something like that, that it's going to solve everything.
Oh, Ernesto, what do you have here? As you know, Ernesto is our chief meme officer at our company, Rayfact. And yeah, we just launched a Web3 card game for kids, 2 to 5 players plus 10 years old. And it's all about Web3, the risks, the opportunities, the challenges. And basically, you play this card game and have to collect Ernesto. Like how he's eating French fries, popcorn, sitting in a workout, these kind of things. So it's really just a super playful way of engaging with the space and actually understanding how it works. So I would really appreciate if you check it out. Of course, we earn some money with that, but every cent, every dollar goes directly towards the free Web3 workshops we do for children. We just had one in Bangkok in November. So I hope you like it. And if you have some feedback, please leave it below. Absolutely makes sense. I know you probably can't be 100% open about this, which is fine. You know, it's, companies have secrets. But are there challenges you at Alchemy are currently facing that or already have solved? Maybe let's put it that way, because then it has a positive nuance to it. Like challenges you have faced in the last, is it 6 months? Yeah, something.
Yeah.
At Alchemy, like that you have solved already.
Yeah, totally. So first of all, I think I definitely can be transparent on this because this is stuff that our whole industry probably feels, right? Like the biggest challenge is just, you know, crypto has this bold bear market cycle where in a bear market, like people aren't developing stuff as much. And if you're selling an infrastructure product where it, you know, relies on people developing a lot of stuff, that also brings challenges to maintaining a consistent business cycle, right? I think this is stuff that all blockchain infrastructure providers feel. Because of that, you know, people become like a lot more price sensitive, for example. But that's pushed our team like to get better internally at like focusing on value selling as opposed to selling purely on transactional things like, you know, price. We've also like, because like specifically the RPC market has gotten to the state where there's like a lot of players now and the price has come down a lot on those. We've kind of gotten ahead of that by building out a lot of other business units and services as well so that we can serve our customers even better, right? So for example, Alchemy used to only do like RPC as basic blockchain infrastructure, but now we also do like data indexing via subgraphs, and we have wallet services solutions to be able to provide easier onboarding paths for people, right? So I think where companies make this mistake is if, and this isn't just unique to Web3, if like you're going through a macroeconomic cycle and you're seeing like, you know, all companies in the space start to struggle a bit, if you just only keep focusing on doing what you're doing and you don't innovate, like that's a recipe for disaster. You know, we've continuously always kept coming out with new products and services that present ourselves with new revenue streams, right? So that even if like an older line of business might be not doing as well as it did in the 2021 bull market, that then is replaced by, you know, revenue that we're able to bring in from other areas. And that's the hardest thing about Web3 also, is like it changes so frequently. I think if companies aren't able to innovate and come out with new products that are helpful to customers to keep on top of those trends, that's where it could be a challenge.
Love that. Yeah, it's basically that compete on value, not on price, right? If the price comes down, create more value, build an ecosystem. It's also kind of that Apple approach, I would dare to say, right? So, hey, we now also have that, and it seamlessly integrates with that, and you don't have to think about that anymore. And it's, yeah, that just makes sense. This just reminded me of ThirdRep. So it's basically those, they are becoming somewhat your main competitor, or what's your view on that, or your approach to that? Are you collaborating with them? I don't know. I just want to dig a little bit on that side as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So ThirdWeb is an awesome team. They've been doing a lot of good work, like specifically, I think, within Web3 gaming and then also within account abstraction. You are correct that, you know, they have competitor products pretty much to what we do. You know, I think like where Web3 is at right now, it's still such a small industry that any company that's going to get blockchain to be used by mainstream companies, that's something that's a net positive. If we were the only company doing something in this space, that would be a really negative signal, because it would mean that other founders, other VCs, other developers don't find these things valuable to build or invest in, right? So I actually view that as like a positive thing. And I think the fact that more competitors are popping up is not only a sign of market validation, but it's also something that keeps us on top of our toes to keep innovating, right?
That's always the thing, right? If you don't have competitors, you either don't have a market or you stop innovating, as you mentioned before. Yeah. And that's just, you know, just a bad thing for everyone, right? Because people strive for growth, right? From a personal, from a mindset perspective, right? If you are going towards something, like growing a company, creating more value, giving something, it's to, yeah, that's what a company is for, somewhat.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and that's the cool thing, I think, about blockchain technologies in general, and also a cool thing about infrastructure is that it really is a game where, like, the people that create the best products that developers like the most are going to be the ones that are successful in the long term, right? It's not going to be a zero-sum game where there's only one company doing this. There's always going to be new blockchains coming out, you know, new, like, entirely new paradigms, like ERC 4337, for example, account abstraction, which has fueled, you know, the growth of companies like ThirdWeb and Alchemy and many others. It's definitely not a zero-sum game where there can only be one company doing this. And, you know, I think ideally there's a lot of companies and, like, healthy competition in the market. You know, I've worked at companies before where there wasn't that level of competition, and then I can say it was a lot harder selling, because that was really a sign that, like, people didn't need our product or service. Right? If there's a lot of people building solutions for stuff, and it's usually a sign that there's a lot of demand. And then the company that's providing the best experience, the best cost, will win in the long run.
And something that I think is, I wouldn't say a sales hack, because it basically just happens, but if a lead actually already has a competitive product in mind and understands that, you don't have to explain your product in depth. You know, you don't have that huge possible potential disconnect of what you're doing. You basically can focus on, hey, they're good at that, we're good at that, and you probably rather need that. Maybe it's worthwhile switching, like something like that, right? You spoke a lot about success prior to that as well.
I think that this is more kind of an opinionated question now, but how do you prefer to measure your own success as a manager and the success of your team?
Yeah. Well, the biggest, you know, thing to measure your success as a manager is if your team is successful. You know, that's how I always view it. Like, if you're the leader of the team, like, ultimately, it's your responsibility and it comes down to you, and you should be held accountable on the line whether or not your team succeeds, right? And then, like, to answer the question about, like, the individual team, like, in an SDR role, it's typically based on, like, the number of new meetings that you're setting up, right? And you have a quota around that. And that's the easiest way to measure success. But then I think beyond that, like, professional development is probably the biggest thing to set that apart. And that's something that I've been proud about, like, in all my roles. Like, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's something like a third of all the SDRs that I, you know, have managed in the past have gone on to be leaders in other companies or in more senior roles. So I guess that's probably, like, long story short, that's the biggest thing that's the most fulfilling to me. And, like, the way that I look at measuring success on a longer time frame is, if I'm responsible for training and coaching and developing people, where do they end up, right? Do they end up quitting and washing out of this career path, which a certain percentage of people do? It's sales. It's a hard profession. Mm-hmm. Or do they end up being, you know, the leaders of the future in other companies? And I think the fact that, like, roughly a third of folks that I've worked with in the past have gone on roles like that is a really cool thing for me to just look back on and reflect on after doing this for 8 years.
Yeah, and it's, you're building relationships, right? You never know what happens in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years.
Yeah, and the most rewarding thing too is when you see people actually that you maybe managed or worked with, like, on the same team, like, grow past you. I feel like that's even cooler, and there have definitely been examples of that also. I think a leader who's in the role for the right reason is going to be, like, really motivated by that. You know, and just, like, not to go on a tangent, but the SDR role is really, like, a life-changing career for a lot of people. You know, people who maybe didn't even think that in their life they could earn, like, six figures in a job. The SDR is career path is really a unique role that opens up a door to that. And it's also a unique role in that it allows people the opportunity to learn new skills that they would have had to pay to learn at college while they're on the job. And instead they can get paid to learn those things. So I just think that's really cool. And it's a cool industry to be a part of.
Love that. Yeah. It's a great mindset, right? You as a leader win if your team wins. I think that's,
of course. You know,
I also like that saying from Gary Vaynerchuk, where he said, like, your employees or your team doesn't work for you, you work for them. It's just, you know, a cool mindset shift because...
Yeah, they call it the servant leader mindset. And I definitely, I try to live by that as much as possible and always have that as something to, like, ground me, right? There definitely are, and I've worked for managers where they're in it for the wrong reasons, and it's very clear to the team. And that's almost been good for me to know, like, you know, the opposite, what it feels like to be on a team like that if the leader is just in it for a fancy title or a status or something like that. You know, it was a little bit of a humbling experience going from, like, managing 15 SDRs, having team leads and stuff like that, to being on a team of two where I'm still doing a lot of the prospecting myself. But at the same time, I'm the happiest and most excited and most motivated that I've been at in my whole career because I'm doing stuff I'm passionate about and doing it with great people. And what more could you ask for?
That's the way. Ego off to what
exactly
makes you happy, right? That's the way. Just thinking about metrics, there's a really interesting book, and I'm curious if you have read it. It's a High Output Management from the, I think...
High Output Management. Yeah, no, that's on my list. I haven't read it.
Okay.
What's your biggest takeaway from that?
Well, a lot of things. It's a really you know, at the time when I've read it, I wasn't at that stage, to be fair, right? I wasn't ready for the book, let's put it that way. But one of the things that I took away, and I'm pretty sure you have an opinion on that, is every metric has to have a second metric. For example, when you mentioned about sales reps basically creating a certain amount of calls, that's how you measure success. And I think he was it, or it was the predictable revenue book, not sure, to be honest. He basically said, you then also need to have that, was it?
A quality metric. You have a quantity metric and a quality metric. Yeah, so like in the case of an SDR role, the quantity metric would be how many opportunities are you setting up and sending over to account executives? And then there's really two quality metrics that matter there. Right? One is what's your conversion rate from opportunity that you're handing across to an opportunity that actually becomes pipeline. And this goes back to your question about how do you incentivize the right behaviors, right? The last thing you want is an SDR who's hitting quota, but the account executive isn't able to accept any of those opportunities because either they're too small or there's like a tech incompatibility or something like that. And then the second like quality metric would be close won revenue. But that's a little bit harder because there's also a lot of things that could go wrong in between when the SDR hands off a really good lead to when it's close won, right? There's so many things that could come up that's not the SDR's fault. So I'm actually not a personal fan, and this is a contentious issue. A lot of people will argue otherwise. I do not believe in making close won revenue a part of the SDR comp plan unless it's a bonus. I don't think it should be part of the quota attainment. I think that rather the quality part that SDR should be measured on is what percentage of those ops actually get converted to active pipeline. That's a healthier thing to measure, I think, that's going to mitigate the risk of people just setting up a lot of low quality opportunities while at the same time not overly penalizing the SDR for opportunities that maybe the account executive didn't do a good job, maybe a competitor came in at the last minute that you weren't expecting, maybe the sales cycle dragged on and the initiative, you know, got deprioritized. I know I've worked as a rep on teams before where I was measured on revenue, and it was kind of frustrating when I knew I sent the good lead across and then other factors like that outside of my control came up and it affected my paycheck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely makes sense. And that basically ties into a huge, unfair fact in life in general. It's really difficult to measure what's a fair wage, what's a fair value you should get for your work. It's just in general a huge issue in our society or in life.
Yeah.
Are there, last question, mate, three things you want people to remember where you say, hey, that's something that helps you in your sales career, in life, in whatever, or about alchemy, whatever you want to leave here?
Yeah, totally. So the first one, I think, is going about life and having a what I call a go-giver mindset. This is actually a book that one of my former managers recommended to me to read. And although it's been one of the shortest sales books I've read, and it's actually written as a novel, so like a fiction book. Look it up. It's called The Go-Giver. I'm blanking on the author's name right now, but it's a really good book, and it kind of teaches you a certain way of life that's prioritizing helping other people over things that are just going to benefit you. And, you know, at surface level, that might sound really cliche or cheesy or whatever, but I think it's something that as you progress in your career, and especially as you grow into leadership, it's easy to lose track of that and lose sight of that. And that's something that I always try to remind myself and ask myself about on a daily basis. And it's not only for the team that you work with, but it's also customers, right? Always make sure that you are giving more to customers, whether it's helping them out. Like, I always try to help, you know, prospects at Alchemy with like connecting them with other companies that might be good partners for them, connecting them with venture capitalists, connecting them with chains that might be helpful to build on. And I might know fully well in my head, this is probably never going to be a paying customer for us. Right. And it might be easy for someone to just discount that and say, oh, I, you know, don't have enough time. I'm really busy. I'm not going to help this person. I always try to go that extra mile because I find it always comes back, you know, to be beneficial later on. So that's the first thing, have a go-giver mindset. The second thing is that Web3 is hands-on, so actually use it. I think that's the biggest mistake that I see a lot of people do, especially probably within Web3 sales and business development, is they might study a concept, but they don't actually try it hands-on. So get a burner, hot wallet, try out a new blockchain, try out a new bridging protocol, you know, try out a new exchange, like whatever it might be. Learn about the stuff that you're actually selling and learn. Like, it's like a cheat code, basically, for Web3 sales. You can try out your customer's product before you reach out to them, and then that's going to educate you on their perspective. In, you know, Web2 software sales, usually the product is gated behind a demo form or a paywall or something like that. Whereas in Web3, you can just try it out and then see what the user experience is like and then have a recommendation of how you can help based on that. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is just for sales in general, don't be afraid of being a salesperson. I see a lot of people like hide behind that or say, oh, I'm a consultant or I'm a strategist or I'm a blockchain infrastructure specialist or like use titles like that. There's nothing wrong with being a salesperson. You know, it's embrace the title, embrace the role, and just be a good salesperson and not an asshole.
That's right.
And then, yeah, and then I think it's a lot easier to be successful in the role if you truly believe in what you're doing and you're proud of it. It should never be something that people should be ashamed of, and sometimes I see that.
Love it. The last one was specifically interesting because Web3 has a bad image, salespeople have a bad image. Why not do both together, right?
So,
hey, man, was really a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Likewise, this was fun.
Cool stuff. I hope you liked the episode. Ernesto and I did for sure. So thank you for watching. Leave your feedback below, please, please, please. That really helps us make these episodes better and improve the quality and make it even more interesting to you. And yeah, absolutely check out Alchemy. I love their software product. So the infrastructure, basically, they obviously have both, right? So please check them out. I have the link below in the video description as well. It's a really cool thing and it really solves a pain point, right? If you are in Web3, it just makes your life easier. And that's their slogan, I think, as well, from what I've seen. At least when you Google Alchemy, you will quickly see that's the promise, make dev's life easier. Oh, I almost heard Ernesto. So check him out and yeah, thanks for watching.
Wave Act. The Web3 software company that understands what you want.